Thank you for helping us make Budget Again last year. Thanks to your support, Lutheran Public Radio has been independent and in the black for more than 2.5 years. You've heard us say, now only our listeners can cancel us, and we mean it. Thanks for listening, thanks for your prayers, thanks for your financial support, and we're looking forward to standing with you again in 2011. Christ-centered, cross-focused talk radio for the world, issues, etc.
And as far as liberty is meaningful, that liberty to these women would mean liberty from being forced to continue the unwanted pregnancy. Even though the state in its brief points out the development of the fetus at an 8-week period, the same state does not require any death certificate or any formalities of birth, that the products of such a conception would be handled merely as a pathological specimen.
Some of the arguments made by attorney Sarah Weddington representing Jane Doe in the U.S. Supreme Court case Roe versus Wade 38 years ago tomorrow, the 22nd of January, 38 years of legalized abortion. How did we get to this point? But more importantly, since things aren't going to change drastically in the near future, what has been the result of Roe v. Wade legally, socially, philosophically? We'll answer that question here in this hour of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. It's Friday afternoon, the 21st of January. We're coming to you live. Our call-in number, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. After a conversation with Dr. Frank Beckwith of Baylor University about 38 years of legalized abortion in the U.S., we'll play Issues, Etc., soundbite of the week. You can vote in advance at our Facebook fan page, facebook.com/issuesetc. Send us a tweet at issuesetc, an email talkback@issuesetc.org, or the phone number again, 1-877-623-6943. Dr. Frank Beckwith is professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas. He's author of the book Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion Choice. Dr. Beckwith, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me, Todd.
You say early on in your book that even to this day, the public doesn't seem to fully understand or appreciate the scope of what the court declared as a constitutional right on that fateful day in 1973. What do you mean?
Well, there's many aspects of Roe that people don't understand. One is that Roe v. Wade was a radical opinion. It's usually portrayed by some folks as a kind of moderate opinion that only allows abortion in the first trimester. But in fact, Roe v. Wade not only permits abortion for all 9 months of pregnancy, it actually says that the fetus, the unborn child, is not and never has been a constitutional person. So even if, let's say, the state of Missouri or Texas decides in some way to have some restrictions in the last trimester, they can only do so for purely medical reasons having to do with some abstract view of respect for life, but they could not do it because either state believes that the unborn child is a human person, ought to be protected under the Constitution. Secondly, a lot of people don't know the reasoning of Roe v. Wade. Roe v. Wade offered an account of the history of abortion law as well as an understanding of the Constitution that simply can't be defended. In fact, a lot of folks at the time, in fact, you rarely find this today, but a lot of folks back then who were actually liberal on abortion were kind of embarrassed by Roe v. Wade. The legal reasoning was horrid, and today usually people who are pro-choice will automatically agree with Roe v. Wade, but back then, I guess I'd say up until maybe 15 years ago, people, it wouldn't be unusual, for example, to hear people say, Roe v. Wade was poorly reasoned, but I still think that abortion should be legal. That kind of thinking is virtually gone today, but if you look at the opinion carefully, and in my book, Defending Life, I have an entire chapter criticizing it. It's not only bad in terms of its moral implications, in terms of excluding the unborn, it's also not a very good piece of legal reasoning.
Now, bad legal reasoning, since Supreme Court decisions are precedents, can lead to more bad legal reasoning. And, of course, Roe has. What has been the legal result of Roe v. Wade?
Boy, it's. I think it's distorted much of our jurisprudence today. Once you'd go down the road that abortion is this fundamental right, what happens is that because most folks who are for abortion rights see the protection of it in terms of who's on the Supreme Court and who's on the lower federal court. So what happens is that every appointment to every major court or every federal court becomes a big debate in this country. We've seen it through the appointment of Supreme Court justices and even some lower court justices. And in that sense, it actually then distorts the justice's own reasoning based on the merits of particular cases. For example, in Casey versus Planned Parenthood, we had, I think, six or maybe seven of the appointees were appointed by conservative Republican presidents who were pro-life. You had three of those justices, Souter, O'Connor, and Kennedy, voting to uphold Roe v. Wade. And one of their reasons was that people had grown accustomed to abortion. And because of that, it would be wrong for the court to overturn it. And in addition, they also argued that people would lose respect for the court for, you know, succumbing to political pressure. So ironically, though, that the court actually doesn't give you a legal reason. What they give you is a sociological reason and a reason based on popularity, a political reason.
That's just strange. Imagine the Supreme Court saying people have grown accustomed to slavery.
Yes.
Slavery is an institution in our country, like it or not, and we don't want to succumb to any political pressure.
Well, you know, the irony is that's why we have political branches. So that, let's say, supposing for the sake of argument, you know, people began, as they were in the 1960s, becoming more receptive to abortion rights. Well, you have legislative process to deal with that so that people can argue it out. And what Roe v. Wade did, ironically, was to short-circuit that process and winds up actually energizing the pro-life movement. I'm not sure there would have been a pro-life movement as big and as important politically if it weren't for Roe v. Wade. Politically, the abortion rights side was actually winning. And what happened was with Roe v. Wade, it actually drew attention to abortion in ways that I don't think the political debate ever would have. Now, if I had my druthers, I wouldn't want Roe v. Wade to have passed. But you're right. I mean, the reality is that the sort of reasoning you find in these later opinions is purely political. I mean, there's nothing in it about the Constitution or even the nature of the law.
Now, has it also produced nonsensical, in some ways kind of tragically nonsensical, legal situations where, for instance, fetal homicide laws can be passed that apply if a man uses a gun but not if a doctor uses a forceps or a syringe?
That's right. That's right. It's crazy. There's a case, actually it's probably several cases throughout the country, but I know one in particular in California where a woman was in a car accident. She suffered a miscarriage, and the other driver was actually sued for negligent homicide and prosecuted as well. Now, it would be wrongful death if it were a civil lawsuit, but negligent homicide if it's a criminal case. And I bring this up in class to my students when I teach a philosophy of law, and usually, you know, they say, you know, so my pro-choice students will say, well, that's great, you know, that she should be able to sue. And I'll change the facts, and I'll ask them this: well, what if she were driving to the abortion clinic and the other driver was the doctor? Would that change it? And you see what's happened, Todd, is that people fail to they start looking at the law as our exercise of power of what we want, rather than asking the question, what is it? I tell this to my students at Baylor. If somebody asks you how you define something, that's different from asking you, what is it? Those are two different ways of looking at the question. And so with abortion, we tend to make it as if we get to define what a human being is, rather than asking the question, well, what is a human being? And once we know what it is, we should honor that being. So you find that's why the law has all these weird things in it, because people don't ask the right question.
With only about 30 seconds here, Dr. Beckwith, before we take our break, it sounds as though what Roe has done, laying this rickety legal foundation, it has not only resulted in further bad decisions in law, it has completely tainted the way we choose the highest court in the land. I mean, it's always the subtext of every
Absolutely.
Supreme Court nominee hearing. And it sounds like it has given us a inconsistent set of laws on the issue of, at the very least, fetal homicide. Is that a good summary of its legal results?
I think that's right. And it's also it's distorted our politics in ways that I don't think anyone have anticipated in 1973. Back then, it wasn't clear which political party was going to be predominantly pro-life. In those days, there were a lot of pro-life Democrats and a lot of pro-choice Republicans. And it's actually made it almost impossible now for people that are liberal to actually be pro-life and win elections. It is remarkable.
When we come back, we'll talk more about the legal, the social, the philosophical results of 38 years of legalized abortion. Of course, the anniversary of Roe v. Wade will be celebrated by some and mourned by others, rightly so, tomorrow on the 22nd of January. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. He's professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, author of the book Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion Choice. When you purchase the book Defending Life using the Amazon.com link at our website, a percentage of your purchase will help support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. IssuesETC.org. Click Listen on Demand. Look for Defending Life by Dr. Frank Beckwith. If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most radio talk shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. We rely on you to pay for the production, salary, and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin, asking you to consider making a tax-deductible gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio. The address? LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend on you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc. Thanks for your consideration.
An umbilical cord of biblical truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Thanks for sending us your email. Having produced Issues Etc. for more than 15 years, I can tell you that we've never received email response like this. Unfortunately, we simply can't reply to all of your email. So here's a way that I can almost guarantee a response to your question or comment. Call the Issues Etc. comment line, 618-223-8384. It's available for your questions or comments 24/7, 618-223-8384.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. live on most smartphones? Just go to the Listen Live page of our website, issuesetc.org, click the smartphone link, and you can listen on your smartphone weekday afternoons between 3 to 5 Central. Old Theology, New Technology, Issues Etc. now broadcasting live to the world on most smartphones. Issues Etc. issuesetc.org.
To return to the law, as Graham does in making a demand upon the willful act of the sinful individual, distracts by turning the individual subject back to his own efforts.
Worse, is she, her doubtless personal virtues aside, a subordinate of the great Sinatocrat of March 2008? Can Sinatocratism produce non-Sinatocratism?
If I know an adulterous heterosexual presents him or herself to the altar without repentance, I'm not going to commune with that person until they come to repentance.
Singing, we will praise you. Woo! Praise you. Woo! We will praise you.
Can I turn off his
praise
mic?
Praise you.
Well, from the sublime to the ridiculous in about 20 minutes, Issues Etc. soundbite of the week, just a taste of the four soundbites we'll be playing for you then. It's a very simple game. All you do is listen, and then you vote for soundbite of the week. That's about 20 minutes now. From now, here on Issues Etc. In the meantime, Dr. Frank Beckwith is our guest. We're remembering 38 years of legalized abortion in the U.S. Dr. Beckwith, you alluded to this before the break, but let's talk about it just a little bit, and that is how Roe v. Wade has, in many ways, I think, kind of taken some of the vigor out of our politics. Here's my theory, and tell me if you think I might be right. With Roe v. Wade overshadowing everything, with abortion basically being the elephant in every political room and in both political parties, we may not have been able to accomplish politically in the last almost 40 years many things that could have been accomplished, because this is always looming there. It controls how people vote, and what is of primary importance to them.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. A friend of mine named Paige Cunningham, who's a director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, calls it the abortion distortion. And I think she's perfect. She's absolutely correct on this. What's happened, I mean, I see it especially with the way in which Christian citizens are assessed by the secular world. I mean, you take away the issues of abortion and same-sex marriage, there really isn't much left that sort of really animate Christians in terms of the public square. Now, many Christians obviously are concerned and interested in a variety of other issues, but on those issues we can find common ground with secularists. But for some reason, those two issues have, in a way, marginalized Christians, not only in the public square but in the university. We just had a speaker at Baylor the other day, a very well-known bioethicist, a Jewish gentleman who had published an outstanding book defending the pro-life position in 1975, and I was told that the book was eventually accepted by MIT Press, but it was rejected by several major publishers because their thinking was, well, who the heck would believe this stuff? And so, I mean, there is a sense in which the issue of abortion in particular, but a variety of other or a few other issues, have distorted our politics in ways that, as I said earlier, have, you know, nobody would have anticipated in 1973.
Let's talk about the social ramifications, and this is such a broad topic here. I mean, beginning with, we must acknowledge the millions upon millions of undefended and then exterminated unborn children. If that could be topped, which it can't, what else have been the social effects?
Well, a couple of them. I think it's affected the sexual revolution. I mean, in fact, in some ways, abortion is both a consequence of the sexual revolution as well as a cause for its perpetuation. I mean, prior to the 1960s, most people thought that that sexual intercourse has an intelligible point, and that is to bring children into being. But with the onset of the predominance of contraception, not only obviously available to single people, as well as abortion, that's changed the way people think of human sexuality. I was in my book Defending Life. One of the scholars that I respond to is a philosopher who makes the argument that there is actually no connection between sex and pregnancy. Now, you know, I don't know what planet she's from. I mean, it's odd that people would actually say that, which, by the way, means that deadbeat dads really have no moral obligation to care for their children because, after all, they had sex, and who's to say that sex leads to pregnancy? I mean, this is a kind of bizarre idea, but I think with abortion and some of the other ways in which we've thought about human sexuality, it's affected us. From a more practical point of view, it's also affected us in terms of economics. With all the children that have been killed as a consequence of abortion, we've lost millions of taxpayers. That is, individuals that would actually not only be paying taxes, but would actually be producing, creating more wealth. My friend, a friend of mine who's an economist, Cal Beisner, in a book he wrote several years ago on poverty, has an appendix in the back of his book in which he points out the amount of money that the national treasury has lost as a consequence of abortion. It is stunning. And you think of things like health care, the looming retirement of most of the baby boomers. These are individuals that in many ways took advantage of abortion and the new technologies, and now there is no generation, or there are fewer people in that in the preceding or the subsequent generation that could support them. And so one of the great ironies is that a lot of these folks avoided having many children or had abortions, and now in their old age require the wealth that those children would have produced. And it's ironic.
I mean, kind of in a nutshell, just imagine what America would look like today in terms of the workforce, the tax base, the health of Social Security, which concerns everyone.
Yeah.
If even half of the children that were aborted had not been.
Yeah, I think we've also lost the idea that we're part of a community. I mean, by always thinking of the individual and his self pursuit, which is there's nothing wrong with an individual caring about their good, but to look at one's good as always the exclusion of responsibility or burdens, I think is based on a total misunderstanding of what a human being is. If anything, these sorts of responsibilities. In fact, I think of my father's generation, where men and women had children quite young. And when I was a kid, people back then who were in their 30s seemed to be grown-ups. Today, a lot of the people I know in their 30s don't seem to be grown-ups. I mean, there's a sense in which by sort of perpetuating the ideal of a kind of youth culture, we've actually done something harmful to ourselves in the future.
Let's talk philosophically and in particular ethically. How has 38 years of unrestricted abortion changed the way that we as a people think ethically?
Well, I think it's changed the way we think about what a person is. Traditionally, Christians in particular, but even other people from other religious and non-religious traditions have always thought that to be a human being is, in fact, to be a person. And that when we look at human beings that are young and underdeveloped, we don't say they're less of a person. We just say that they haven't reached their maturity yet. But what abortion has forced a lot of folks to do, especially academics, is to come up with theories so that you can exclude the unborn, but at the same time include those that are born. And what happens is it's a kind of arbitrary, capricious way of treating human beings. And so some philosophers have argued that the unborn aren't persons because they lack certain abilities. Well, they do lack those abilities, but many of us throughout our lives will in fact lack those abilities as well. A person may be in a temporarily comatose state, or an elderly person may be suffering from Alzheimer's. These are all states of what of a human being's life, and to say that somehow to be weak and to be in peril and to be dependent makes you less than human, I think is a very scary notion. And that's why you hear more and more today people talking about, you know, end-of-life issues. Not too long ago, Sarah Palin got a lot of grief for mentioning death panels. Well, I think she had every right to bring that up, and I think it's something that people ought to be concerned about, because the mentality that tells us that that life can be snuffed out before it's fully mature is the same type of mentality that says that life can be snuffed out when it doesn't seem to be benefiting other people. And that's scary.
A quick question from Matt in Seward, Nebraska. He says, would your guest answer the question, what he thinks about the argument that legal and available abortion has at least reduced crime in the last 30 years? About a minute to respond.
Well, it may or may not be true. It's actually based on a paper that a couple of Stanford University professors put together. That may be true, but, you know, there's even a better way to reduce crime. We could execute everyone who's presently in prison. Now, the question then is that the right thing to do? In addition to that, if abortion is wrong, that means, in a sense, a moral crime has been committed against millions. And so we can't say that crime has been reduced. If anything, a moral crime has increased. And so once again, we have to get back to the question, what is the unborn and does it have a right to life?
And we'll talk about that on the other side of the break, the basic argument that must be maintained in the face of 38 years of legalized abortion in the U.S. And we'll talk a little bit more about the ethical fabric of the United States as a result of 38 years of abortion. Stay tuned.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and go to the Listen On Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. On Demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org, and click Listen On Demand.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
The call to cherish life.
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
As mentioned in our previous commentary, the North American Mission Board recently held a conference for pregnancy support centers. Richard Land made the attendees aware of the Psalm 139 project, in which donors' gifts are used to install ultrasound machines in pregnancy centers. He reminded attendees that we have just elected the most pro-life Congress since Roe v. Wade. Elaine Hamm, the MC of the conference, told the center directors, "Of all the people in your town, God called you to one of the most important issues of this generation. Live worthy of the call."
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List, inviting you to join us in our battle for life. For more, go online to sba-list.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'm coming to you live this Friday afternoon, January the 21st. Our guest, Dr. Frank Beckwith. Dr. Beckwith, this comes from Marilyn in St. Louis. She writes, "I'm very pleased that Issues Etc. is talking about abortion. Please be sure to cover the topic on how it affects men and man's responsibility in this matter. I hear abortion constantly discussed regarding women and children, but rarely is the man's role discussed as well. Thanks. Your shows are great." What about the man's role, Dr. Beckwith?
Boy, there's a lot of things I can say about that, but specifically, I think it alters the relationship between men and women in a significant way. When a father, you know, somebody sires a child, there's a sense that that individual has a special responsibility to that child. But according to our laws, the woman has absolute and total sovereignty over the child she's carrying. So even if that father wants to care for that child, she can have an abortion nonetheless. Secondly, it affects men in ways that a lot of us don't really think about. Many men, or some men who, let's say, try to encourage their girlfriends or wives to have abortions for a variety of reasons, later in life sometimes feel tremendous guilt as a consequence. There are cases, I've done some work with the crisis pregnancy centers, several of them throughout the country, and one of the things we've discovered is that certain men, they may have done that when they were young, and they get older, and they get married and become settled and have children of their own, and they start seeing those children not just as their present children, but they connect them to those children they didn't have. And that creates a sense of guilt and a sense of loss. And so men do get affected in different ways than women, because men and women are different, but they do get affected. And I do think it has a negative impact on a man's natural tendency to be a leader in the home, to be a father. Remember, abortion, as that has increased and become more prevalent, so has the absence of men in the home. And I don't think it's a coincidence. There's a tendency, once you think of an individual as simply having absolute sovereignty over an unborn child, it seems to me that then you also have a kind of logic that's teased out, that that therefore a second parent is not relevant, or in this case a male. And we've seen that in most predominantly in the inner cities of our country, young men and young girls not having fathers. And so, I mean, I think this is there's a connection there, but I do think in terms of abortion, we sometimes ignore the guilt that men feel, and also the absence of any say if they don't want the woman to have an abortion.
We've only got about 30 seconds. What's the central question here, even after 38 years of legalized abortion? 30 seconds, Dr. Beckwith.
Yeah. The central question is this. What is the nature of the unborn? Or more generally, who and what are we, and can we know it? This is often, believe it or not, ignored, but if the unborn child is one of us, that is, it is an intrinsically valuable human being that ought to be protected by our laws, and that we should treat it as such. And the reality is that if we do, we're going to have to change our lifestyle. We're going to have to think more in terms of our relationship to our children, and as children to our parents. And this is going to be strange, especially in some areas of the United States. We have forgotten so much of what it's means to be part of the family. But I think ultimately that's the question. Who and what are we, and can we know it?
Dr. Frank Beckwith is professor of philosophy and church-state studies at Baylor University in Waco, Texas, author of the book Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion Choice. Thank you very much, Dr. Beckwith.
Well, thanks for having me.